Welcome to State of Affairs. I'm Julie Credens. There are an estimated 27 million people in slavery worldwide, a majority of them in India and African countries. But each year, thousands of slaves are trafficked into the United States, too. This hour, we look at the problem of modern slavery with our guest, Dr. Kevin Bales. He is the recipient of the 2011 University of Louisville Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order, awarded for his book, Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. He's also founder and president of Free the Slaves, the U.S. sister organization of Anti-Slavery International. He joins us by phone today. Dr. Kevin Bales, congratulations on the Grawemeyer, and welcome to the show. Hello.
Julie, it's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, certainly. And I guess, Kevin, I'd like to start by looking at the scope of this problem. I just referenced this number, 27 million people. That was taken from the Free the Slaves website. But I've heard you say in other interviews that this is a conservative estimate.
It is, because when we first developed that estimate, now I want to admit that's a few years old now, we tried our best to only use those pieces of information that we just felt were absolutely unimpeachable. And no one knows exactly how many people are in the world in slavery, because it's a criminal activity, and in lots of places it's hidden. But we feel pretty secure in saying it's something of that magnitude, something of that order.
And I referenced India and African countries as the countries where a majority of slaves are. Is that still the case?
That's right. And, of course, a lot of that's just to do with the sheer size of the populations in Asia and Africa, but particularly India and China, you know, with over a billion people in each of those countries, there's a lot of room to catch people up into slavery, and especially in a country like India, where you have a long-term historical types of slavery, so that you find people who are in what we could call human trafficking, but you also find lots of people in India who are in hereditary forms of slavery, trapped in it for generations.
Is there a difference between the term slavery and human trafficking?
Not really, in the sense that human trafficking is simply a process by which people are brought into a situation of slavery. You know, if a person's carried from one place to another or moved, recruited, lured into a situation where they end up in slavery, that's what's called human trafficking. So there are people who are moved into slavery through that thing called human trafficking, but they're only a smaller part of all the slaves in the world.
And I want to talk a little bit more about the kind of slavery you referenced in India, for example, but you've also talked about that though modern-day slavery has its own set of circumstances, the essential elements of slavery really have not changed through the history of human slavery.
Well, that's exactly right, which is why we still call it slavery. You know, if a person is under the complete control of another person, they use violence to maintain that control. They use that violent control to exploit them, make money off of them. That's what slavery is all about, the fact that the slave has lost almost all of their free will. But there are some big changes that have to do with slavery today, but it's not about the nature of slavery in the sense of total control and exploitation. It's about the price of slaves.
Well, what are those trends, then, that have contributed most to the rise of what we call now modern slavery, slavery today?
Well, the key thing is that in the last 50, 60 years, you know, the global population has gone from about 2 billion people to we're just touching 7 billion now. And that's completely unprecedented in the history of our planet. Having lots of people doesn't make them slaves, but if you also look to the fact that we have several billion people, particularly in the developing world, who are very, very poor and caught in situations of great vulnerability. You know, they're not protected by police. Their lives, their communities are rocked by natural disasters or disease epidemics or civil wars, conflicts, or sometimes all of the above at the same time. And it pushes them to a situation where if someone else has the means of violence, someone else can take control of them, well, they can, because there's no police there to protect them. So we have a much larger pool of potentially enslavable people in the world today. And in the basic notions of supply and demand, that has caused a collapse in the price of human beings.
What, and again, that this is a point that you make that is rather stunning and leads to discussions on treatment of slaves, that they are cheap compared to history, let's say. Did you say an average cost of $90?
Around the world today, the best figure we've got is that the average cost of a person in slavery, to acquire a person in slavery, is around $90 today. That might be in the low thousands in the United States or Western Europe, but I've certainly met people in places like India or Pakistan who have been enslaved for as little as $5 or $10. And you compare that, say, to how much it would it cost to buy a slave in Louisville, Kentucky in 1850. And the answer is the average agricultural worker, say a 19-year-old young man who would work in the fields, would cost between $1,000 and $1,250, which is about $40,000 to $50,000 in today's money.
Well, and the frightening part about that, Dr. Bales, it seems, is that if the price is so cheap, life becomes cheap. It's not. And not to say that slaveholders in the U.S. in the early 19th century were great caretakers, all of them universally. This idea of it's not worth protecting, really. You know, keeping slaves healthy or even keeping them alive in some cases may not be worth it at those prices.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. In the past, Southern slave owners, for example, were making capital purchases when they bought a person into slavery. Or when they bought a slave, because it would take years to earn back in profits what it cost to pay for a slave. It was like buying a tractor or a major piece of equipment. And the price of a slave in 1850 in Kentucky was about the same as you could buy a house for at the same time. Today, slaves are disposable inputs into economic processes of whatever sort. I mean, they're much more like styrofoam cups or those little cheap plastic ballpoint pens that we all use. You know, they're very inexpensive. You can use them as hard as you like. You don't worry about taking care of them. And when they break down, you just crumple them up and throw them away.
And get new ones.
It
is appalling. Tell us a little bit about the work of Free the Slaves, your organization.
Certainly. We work on several levels, but our absolute greatest focus is on liberating people from slavery and helping them to rebuild their lives. I mean, of course, we do public awareness work and we work to advocate in Congress and so forth, but the majority of our work is done on the ground with partner organizations in many countries around the world, finding those individuals or communities who are caught in slavery and then helping them to reach that moment of liberation, protecting them when slaveholders want to use violence to keep them in slavery. And especially important is sticking with them, usually for 2 to 3 years afterwards, to make sure that they're able to build lives that will be safe and have education and a real citizenship and achieve a sense of dignity. So that's the key thing that we do.
And that's talking about sort of your process, working with local groups. It seems that's so key because it seems this can't be a matter of, well, here's this outside agency coming in to fix this problem, that it really does have to be collaborative and, as you say, on the ground rather than some sort of paternalistic, you know, outside influence.
The last thing we're going to do is parachute in and say we're some kind of heroes that are liberating people. We know that the people who are in slavery themselves know what they need. They're happy to have some advice or suggestions, but they really know what they need. And they're also the ones who have to bring the guts, the courage, and the intelligence to that getting out of slavery. It's a tricky one. Now, it's also true that on one level, we shouldn't have to do this because slavery is illegal in every country. Really, government should be shouldering the responsibility and the cost of making sure that there is no slavery in their country, you know, in the country. Each government should be making sure there's no slavery in their country. But until that happens, we're not going to wait for that to happen as long as people are in slavery. We're just going to do what we must do and then also urge governments to fulfill the promises they've made to their own citizens.
Well, when you talk about elements that sort of create the conditions in which slavery can occur, then you do have to look at government corruption, don't you?
Well, corruption, in fact, governmental and especially law enforcement, police corruption, is the strongest predictor of whether or not slavery exists in any place. Because if the rule of law has broken down, if the rule of law ceases to protect the poor and the vulnerable, then it's open season. And people who want to take others into slavery can do so. So I admit, you know, that's a tall order, dealing with corruption. Or, you know, you can go a step beyond corruption all the way to those places like Congo, where we're working at the moment, in eastern Congo, where there's no there's corruption, but it's total chaos because it's a civil war with five or six different armed groups fighting each other. And it's, in a sense, it's gone far beyond the normal sense of a corrupt law enforcement system to no system whatsoever.
I suppose we're a little ahead of ourselves, and we don't have time to get into this too much before the break. But then when we talk about international pressure, I can easily see some countries, you know, claiming sovereignty, you know, that this is our affair. We'll take care of our affairs in our own country if slavery exists. You know, this sort of line. Do you come upon that?
Sometimes, and certainly there are countries that that say, well, you know, maybe we have a little bit, but it's just a little vestige of something, and it's really nothing anyone should be bothering us about. Singapore is a great example of a city-state that's got significant amounts of human trafficking in for construction work and domestic service and prostitution, and yet they just keep basically answering any criticisms with, mind your own business.
Wow. When we come back, I want to maybe pick up there and look at more specific examples of the kinds of slave situations you've uncovered in your work. Dr. Kevin Bales, recipient of the 2011 Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. I wonder, how aware are you about the problem of modern slavery, about the level of human trafficking that occurs here in the U.S.? We'll be touching on that as well. Your questions and comments are welcome at 877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. Send an email to soa@wfpl.org. From WFPL in Louisville, you're listening to State of Affairs. Welcome back to State of Affairs. I'm Julie Credens. We're talking with Dr. Kevin Bales, founder and president of Free the Slaves, a Washington, D.C.-based human rights organization. He's the recipient of the 2011 University of Louisville Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. It was earned for his book, Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. We've been looking at the problem of modern slavery. We're going to be talking about a few examples and the kind of work that Kevin does with Free the Slaves. But we also want you to join in with your questions and comments. 877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. Again, you can send your emails to soa@wfpl.org. Reach us on Twitter at soatalk or through Facebook. Kevin, back to your work and some more examples. You talked about Singapore, but I wonder, how does your organization, how do you learn about slavery situations, where and how it's happening? Is this where you rely upon local groups within the country trying to do the same kind of work?
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, in terms of how we learn about it, we're often on the ground ourselves. Mm. So, I mean, just in the last year, I've been in Congo and Bangladesh and gone to Western Africa and so forth, doing that investigative work on the ground to determine what the situation might be. But when we go to work there, we know that it's the local people who are going to be best suited to know and speak the languages and understand the cultures to help us find the best ways to help people out of slavery.
Let's talk a little bit more, if we can, about India and again, the types of slavery. You've written about hereditary slavery, hereditary debt bondage. What do these things mean? How does this work?
Well, hereditary, I mean, the debt bondage sounds like something, you know, the average American might
yes.
have a problem with. You know, I've got this car note and I've got this mortgage, and boy, is it hang over my head all the time. But this is rather different to that. The kind of official name is collateral hereditary debt bondage. And what that means is that sometime in the past, imagine that your grandfather was desperate for some money to buy some medicine to save your grandmother, and had to go to a money lender. And the money lender gave them the money, but because your grandfather was very poor and had nothing to put up as collateral, the money lender says, well, that's fine. I'm going to take you and your family and all the work that you can do as the collateral. Mm-hmm. So you and your family and all the work that you do is mine until you pay the debt back. Well, I think anybody can see the catch-22 there. You know, if you and all your work already belongs to this person, how on earth are you going to get anything to pay them back with? So the debt passes down generation to generation, and it's simply a mechanism, a kind of cover story that lures people into slavery, but then locks them down there for generations.
In which countries, Kevin, is that most prevalent, that type of slavery?
That's primarily in Southeast Asia. So you'll find it in Nepal and Pakistan and India especially, a little bit in Sri Lanka.
When you mentioned, you know, people working with people on the ground who understand the culture of a place, too, and we look at maybe a country like India, we've long heard of, you know, the caste system. Do societies, do things like that, expectations sort of play into all of this? And I'm not at all suggesting that people in slavery or debt bondage are, you know, content with their lot. But is there a sense sometimes of this is our culture, this is how it is, and this is my lot?
Well, and certainly slaveholders, the slave masters, like to generate that idea over and over in the minds of people they've enslaved. So it's true that people who are Dalits, you know, untouchables in the Indian caste system, tend to be in great poverty, which means they're more likely to take out such loans and more likely to end up in hereditary slavery, debt bondage slavery. And of course, the masters who then control their lives, don't let them leave their little local area. They never get access to any kind of education or public media or newspapers, any of that stuff, are constantly telling them, well, you know, you are like children, you need to be cared for, you need to be disciplined, and so forth. And of course, that kind of cultural rationalization happens in other places of the world, too. You know, if you go to Southeast Asia, like Thailand, a young girl, a 14-year-old girl, might end up captured and enslaved and forced into prostitution. But within their type of twist that the slaveholder will put on Buddhist ideas, they'll say, well, you know, it's really too bad you've ended up in slavery, but clearly this is your karma. You've done something in a previous life that makes this inevitable. Now, that's, you know, that's not true Buddhism. That's a lie. That's a twist. But it's not the first time that religion has been used to rationalize and justify slavery.
So certainly, I mean, there's a whole psychological component to slavery, as we know, and not just the physical, but the enslavement of the mind as well.
Slaveholders really like the fact that you can put a chain around someone's brain, because it means that you don't have to put a chain around their ankle. If you know, psychological control is in many ways so much more effective than physical. And to achieve that, and you know, the cases are here in the United States as well, people who have been shifted into the United States in order to enslave them are often subject to sleep deprivation and food deprivation, as well as regular beatings. And if you can imagine, you know, not being allowed to sleep for days on end or fed and then beaten up regularly, how very malleable you might soon become to someone else's ideas.
Absolutely. You're listening to State of Affairs. Our guest this hour is Dr. Kevin Bales. He was awarded the 2011 U of L Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order for his book Ending Slavery. And we'll be looking more closely at that book. It provides strategies for ending modern slavery. That's what we're focusing on this hour, learning about the scope of the problem. I welcome your questions and comments. 877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. And joining us now here in Louisville is Heidi. And welcome to the show, Heidi. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Dr. Bales, congratulations on your award.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
You're welcome. I just wanted to say that it's closer here than we think. Someone from Catholic Charities who works with human trafficking survivors came and spoke to us. And there was a group broken up in Jeffersonville and in Shelbyville as well. And that we just need to understand that if we participate even in any spending habits that create depression or oppression, that this creates an environment where people need money to live and can bring that chain around people's brains. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to throw that out.
Heidi, I'm so glad you called. And Dr. Bell, she references Jeffersonville, which is just across the river from us in Indiana, across the river from Louisville, and Shelbyville, sort of on the in a neighboring county here. Slavery rings there. And again, let's shift the focus, thank you, Heidi, to trafficking in the U.S., because it does go back to the idea that it's hidden in plain sight, so to speak. What do we know about human trafficking here in the States?
Well, it certainly occurs in every single state. We know that. In fact, there have been law enforcement federal cases and state cases, busts and prosecutions in every one of the 50 states. Our estimate is a very conservative one, again, and says that probably 40 to 50,000 people are caught up in slavery in the United States. We know that the largest proportion of that, but not even half, are probably those women who have been brought into the country from many different countries who are caught up into forced, enslaved prostitution. That's something just under half. And then domestic servants make up a very large next level, as well as agricultural workers. But I have to tell you from doing a lot of work in the United States that you would be astounded at all the different types of ways that clever criminals have found to enslave people. And I'll just mention, to my mind, one of the craziest was an entire boys' choir from the country of Zambia that were brought to the United States and enslaved as part of a charity scam, singing in churches and raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for a criminal.
How does this happen? Are the victims that generally of the same national origin as the traffickers exploiting them, getting them here? How do those connections get made?
That's the usual pattern, is that people trafficked into the country from China will be trafficked in by Chinese who live here and so forth, and from West Africa and so forth. Though another part of that pattern is that the traffickers may be from the same nationality, but are often of a different ethnic group within that nationality or a higher class or social status. So, it's often sort of urbane Chinese Americans who might then be trafficking in what you could say are sort of country bumpkins from rural China, able to have that extra knowledge and sophistication that allows it more easily them to be more easily exploited.
Well, and it's horrifying because, America, I think in many ways, is still looked upon as the land of opportunity, but it seems like that image is what lures victims here as well.
That's precisely right. And it's actually got a very important lesson for all of us, I think, which is we shouldn't think of those who are caught up in human trafficking and enslaved in the United States or other places as being somehow fundamentally different to the rest of us, because they're doing what you or I would do if our kids were hungry. If we were living in a place that had no safety for our families, if we literally couldn't find any kind of work that would pay to support our families, we would be reaching out and saying, well, this guy says he's got a great job for me if I just go over the border with him. We would probably take those risks too if it was our children that we were trying to protect and feed and care for.
What, tell us a little bit more about this boys' choir. What was the conclusion of the case? What was happening there?
Well, at the end of the day, the fact was it was a man who had gone to Zambia. He had heard these boys sing so beautifully.
Was this an American that had gone?
And this was not a Zambian. This was a white American who from Texas who had gone and heard these kids sing and realized, wow, they're going to be amazing if I take them around to churches and have them sing. People are going to pour out their love offerings to build schools and care for these kids. Of course, none of that money went. And at the end, and they would sing in churches. They weren't fed very well. They were all, like a whole bunch of them, forced to sleep all piled up on each other in a trailer and put to very hard physical work in between their concerts, like digging swimming pool holes by hand. At the end of the day, it was a couple of the oldest boys who just got so fed up, they became very, very kind of cross and combative about it. And his answer to this was to just try to have them deported. He was just going to have them thrown out of the country by reporting them to the Immigration Service then. And luckily, it was the immigration officers who said, wait, something else is going on here. Let's dig a little deeper. And all those boys were freed. And some of them are still living in the United States who were orphans and are now, this is a few years later, are now, you know, very successfully pursuing their educational careers. The perpetrator was on his way to trial, but in fact died of a brain hemorrhage, and so there was no legal resolution to it.
Well, I want to touch, too, on something that seems to be have to play a role here somewhere, is U.S. immigration policy. You know, there are many people just, you know, going through every hoop they can to try to become citizens, to gain entry. How are these future slaves, let's say, brought into the country? How do the traffickers get around any of that?
Well, I wish that in some ways they had to get around it. Because what I'm going to say is going to make it sound all that much worse, because we have a number of provisions in American immigration policy that makes it easy to enslave people. There are certain visas which are used for agricultural work, and another one that can be used for domestic service work, that once a case has been made to import a worker under that visa, the only time they're ever seen is at the airport when they come in. Their passport is stamped, and then no record is kept of them whatsoever. And it means that they just flow into the country into a situation where the person who's brought them in is completely unmonitored and unregulated, and they can be stepping straight into slavery. I know young women here in the Washington, D.C. area who were brought from West Africa. And these are educated young women. You know, they'd completed high school. And one of the reasons they really wanted to come and take these kind of au pair positions, these domestic service positions, was because of a chance. They were promised a chance to go to community college. But once they crossed the border, they were enslaved in people's homes here in the Washington, D.C. area, and stayed that way for several years.
And what is this difficult, though? You said enslaved in the homes of residents of the Washington, D.C. area. Presumably a diverse selection of households here, white, American. What is there a typical profile, let's say? Are the end users typically Americans?
We're back to what we said a moment ago about them often being from the same nationality or ethnicity. Yeah. So they're very often American citizens, but they're also very often of originally having come from the same country where the trafficked people are from. So that you use those linkages that happen to come with your nationality or culture to make it easier to bring people in. On the other hand, it's also true that it does get mixed up. A very significant case a year or so ago in Long Island involved a couple that were Americans, originally from India, but they had brought in Indonesian workers and Malaysian workers and enslaved them in their home.
I want to touch on something quickly in a minute or two before we go to our next break that our caller Heidi had brought up also, that, you know, how we might all be part of this problem in some way in terms of the products that we use every day and the global economy piece of this, Kevin.
Well, it's true. There's slavery in an awful lot of things that we touch every day that are on the shelves and, in our cupboards at home. And I can point to a lot of those. Your cell phone, my laptop, has minerals in it that could well have come out of slavery in East or West Africa. Cotton has some slavery in it, sugar, coffee, cocoa. Shrimp is a area of tremendous growth. Frozen shrimp that you see at the supermarket, a very good chance that there's slavery touching that. The list really does go on and on. The tricky thing here is just that the amount of slavery in any product or commodity is actually usually very, very small. So it's not about saying we have to boycott all shrimp, we have to stop eating or drinking coffee or stop buying cell phones. It's about finding the best way to find that slavery where it originates and then wipe it out there.
But it's nevertheless a good thing to point out so that we are more mindful of this problem, that it's not something that happens elsewhere or something that we are not somehow a part of or contributing to the economy of it, I suppose.
Absolutely. And it's not just that we're contributing to the economy from, the cocoa or coffee that we get from overseas, since we don't grow those in the United States, because there's slavery right in the United States, mm-hmm. down in South Florida, in things like tomatoes and oranges and other kinds of fruit.
Is it possible to, certainly for any of us to be an unwitting partner in this? Let's say you have a business in which you use subcontractors, for example. Are there questions that should be asked? Does that happen?
That's absolutely the case. I mean, if you're stocking goods on the shelves of your shops that are coming from lots of parts of the world and could easily have been processed by people who are caught up in slavery, it's very interesting and very important to look at your subcontractors. The state of California has just passed a law that will come into effect next January that requires businesses over a certain size to report every year on their websites and permanently in their publications exactly what they're doing to look closely at their supply chains and explain how they're looking hard at their subcontractors.
Well, that's certainly encouraging. And when we come back from this break, Kevin, I'd like to turn towards solutions now and strategies for trying to end this global problem. We're talking with Dr. Kevin Bales. He is founder and president of Free the Slaves. He's also the 2011 recipient of the Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order for his book, Ending Slavery. You're invited to join in. Your questions or comments, 877-814-TALK. 877-814-8255. From the studios of WFPL in Louisville, you're listening to State of Affairs. Welcome back to State of Affairs. I'm Julie Credens. Our conversation continues now with Dr. Kevin Bales. He is founder and president of Free the Slaves. It's a Washington, D.C.-based human rights organization. He's the recipient of the 2011 U of L Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order, earned for his book Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. You're welcome to join in at 877-814-TALK, 877-814-8255. Kevin, let's get into these, your ideas for improving world order, in this case for improving and solving the problem of modern slavery. Where do you begin? I mean, certainly the kind of work Free the Slaves is doing, but what else is this going to require?
Oh, well, we have to, as you can imagine, attack this problem across a whole wide range of dimensions. So the book Ending Slavery, you know, has one section about what government should be doing to enforce their own laws, another section about what the United Nations and other international bodies can be doing and so forth, and also about what we can do as consumers and community folk. And all of these, you know, will have to fit together to make it all work. In some ways, the good news is that you're actually improving world order in ways that would surprise you, I think, because one of the things that's little understood is just how much, for example, environmental destruction is linked to slave labor. Mm-hmm. That a lot of what goes on in chopping down the world's forests or ruining the environment is actually accomplished by criminals who use slave labor and who aren't regulated by, you know, international environmental treaties. So bringing it into slavery doesn't just stop the terrible moral problem we face, but it's going to help us a lot with environmental problems and development issues and global economics as well.
Well, I think that example you give is an interesting one, not only in the activity itself, the criminal activity itself, but then sort of going back to resource depletion, that, you know, as the population continues to grow and there are limited resources, it seems, as you mentioned at the beginning, that slavery can happen where there are precious resources to be allocated and not, you know, that people may enter into things out of desperation.
Certainly that's the case. And those who are desperate, and there's a lot of people in the world, not by any means through their own fault, mm-hmm. who have been caught up in situations of civil war or conflict or epidemic or whatever, who are desperate and are lured into the kind of work that exploits them horrifically and often kills them in order to generate things like the minerals that go into our cell phones or other kinds of, or gold or some food commodities that then feed into the global market but also feed a lot of money into the pockets of the slaveholders and the slave masters.
Let's look, you know, your book, you said, tackles sort of three areas that have to each work on this issue. Governments, certainly you talk about the United Nations and individuals as well. Let's look at governments, though, and I wonder which countries do you think have the most aggressive policies or protections and prosecution of slave traders when it's discovered?
I wish I could say the United States was the gold standard, but I don't think it is. I think Brazil is, in fact, the gold standard. And I would love to see Brazil, I would love to see the United States adopting a number of the things that they do in Brazil. For example, Brazil maintains what they call the dirty list. And what that is a list on the Internet of every company and every economic enterprise that's been arrested, where an arrest is made or a prosecution or an investigation has been made about slave labor. So that if you had any concerns and you're in Brazil about, I don't want to do business with anyone who does slavery, you've just got to go on the Internet and look up the dirty list for slavery, and it'll tell you who's safe and who's not. Another thing is that in Brazil, they have what they call a mobile anti-slavery squads. So if you can imagine, police, but who are absolutely independent to move anywhere they want to around the country to attack and follow slaveholders, human trafficking, and fly in with, sometimes fly, sometimes in trucks, but and go straight to where the crime's happening, because they're real specialists. They really understand what the crime of slavery looks like. And they actually carry with them special judges who can rule on the spot about putting certain people into incarceration or locking certain people up, but also in terms of awarding damages to people who have been in slavery. It's a great dynamic model. It's by no means perfect, obviously. It'd be hard to find any place perfect, but they're doing some very interesting work in Brazil.
Are there things that the U.S. could adopt from Brazil, first? And secondly, what is keeping the U.S. from sort of being the gold standard for attacking this problem? I mean, the home of the free and liberty-loving people. What are the barriers here?
I think the barriers are in part about a lack of public awareness. Public awareness is growing very rapidly, and thank you very much, Julie, for letting me be on this radio program, because this is helping to raise public awareness. It's growing, but it's still not to the point that politicians at all levels are saying, wow, we really need to put more resources to this. We really need to take more action to deal with slavery in the United States. The thing that is so very exciting about the United States is that we have solid, almost, uniformly pretty honest police and law enforcement. We have really professional law enforcement. We have people who want to do the right thing. This could be a slave-free country. This could absolutely be probably the first slave-free country in history if we put a little commitment and some resources behind that idea. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the phones now. More folks wanting to join in. Our guest, Dr. Kevin Bales, founder and president of Free the Slaves. Join us at 877-814-TALK. And now Travis is next on State of Affairs. Travis, what's on your mind?
Well, I certainly don't want to mix apples and oranges here, but since he brought up governments, I had a specific question about a specific country. But when we look at countries like Nicaragua the last 4 years under the Sandinista government, who our media is just constantly bombarding us, claiming they're a bad government, yet more children graduated last year from school than any time in the country's history. That government's investing in education and social programs. Same way with Venezuela. In fact, Venezuela helps Nicaragua a lot. Bolivia and Ecuador as well. Those governments are investing money in their youth. Now, this doesn't directly relate so much to sex trafficking, but seems to in slavery. But it seems to me, under a lot of these governments, when they were in U.S.-backed puppets, right-wing governments, most of these kids weren't graduating from school; they were out in the streets. And I just want to pose the question: can we really count on our government really to tell us who the good guys are and the bad guys are in terms of these governments and what's improving? Now, I had a specific question about Honduras, because aside from a brief stint with a leftist sort of leader who was ousted in a coup, they pretty much been under sort of right-wing governments. And my understanding recently, there was a sex trafficking ring busted, and someone had mentioned that Honduras is one of the sweet spots to, get all these slaves. Mm-hmm. And someone was asked about some of these countries like Nicaragua. They said, well, no, they don't want to go there because the government, things are getting better. They like Honduras because of the way, in Guatemala, because of the way our Washington consensus policy have done for those countries. So I didn't want to compare apples and oranges, but I just kind of wanted to say, are these, when countries invest in education, is this a good thing to at least limit this atrocious act?
Okay. Travis, thanks very much. A very thoughtful and well laid out question. Kevin?
Oh, well, in some ways, Travis is onto something very important, and it's got two key parts to it, particularly about corruption and about education. And in many ways, you know, within the anti-slavery movement, we understand that while corruption is the primary driver of trafficking in slavery, education is the primary vaccination or prophylactic against slavery. You know, when you get a well-educated population, it becomes more and more difficult to impose any sort of enslavement upon them. And, you know, it's true that there have been U.S. administrations and other U.S. administrations, and some of them have been good for education in our own country as well as others, and some haven't been so good. And those ripple effects, particularly in poorer countries, can be very strong. So the amount of human trafficking that flows up through Central America and South America is pretty significant as it flows up to the United States. But it is true that those countries that have higher levels of corruption, and you can look at the International Transparency Index listing of who has a higher or lower corruption, they're pretty much perfectly balanced in terms of the ones with higher corruption have the higher amounts of slavery and trafficking.
All right. Travis, again, thank you very much. Great question. And next we'll go to Leonard in Frankfurt. Leonard, welcome to the show.
Well, good afternoon. My question is not the importation of these people. My question is about, what about the Americans that are lured overseas or actually taken overseas at times to fill positions, say, in Southeast Asia or in the Middle East or in the harems of the Arab world or whatever, because there is a great demand for certain types of American females, especially overseas.
All right. So is it not just a problem, Kevin, of people being brought into the U.S., but certainly people living here, citizens or not, being exported, so to speak? Leonard, thank you.
Well, and Leonard's got a point, but I have to say it's a much smaller proportion. Most of the flow is toward the richer countries, not in the other direction. But it's true. You know, criminals will meet criminal demand. And if there are people out there who have got a demand for particular types of human beings that they want to exploit and use, there'll be somebody who will try to do that. That said, it's harder to do that with Americans, even though it's not impossible, in large part because Americans have a higher levels of education and a better understanding of their own rights, for the most part. But that doesn't mean that there's not going to be somebody who's going to be gullible enough to be tricked and lured off into exploitation overseas.
Leonard, thanks very much. Let's go to another sort of part of the strategies here. We've talked about governments sort of individually, and you mentioned Brazil as having some very dynamic ideas on this. But what about collectively? I read here in your bio you are a consultant to the United Nations Global Program on Trafficking of Human Beings. What about the United Nations and an international effort?
Well, the I need to say that was in the past when I worked as a consultant to that part of the UN, but I certainly talked to them a fair bit. The most important thing is really for the United Nations to do what they can do, but they haven't necessarily ever accomplished yet. And what I mean by that is that, you know, a lot of people think the United Nations is a democracy, but it's not really. It's pretty much run by the Security Council, by the 5 to 7 countries that that are on the Security Council, and when they will finally make a decision to take this very seriously across the United Nations, I think we'll begin to see some things happening. Now, what they could do is pretty clear. They need to, for example, train much better the UN peacekeeping forces around the world, who very sadly have sometimes been implicated themselves in situations of exploitation of trafficked people, but train them to recognize and work against trafficking, because we need that kind of international force in those places where chaos rules and the rule of law has broken down. But we also need the United Nations to become much more aware of the fact that when they're doing food programs, water programs, development programs, they're often doing them in the poorest parts of the world where the slavery is most prevalent. But they're not addressing the slavery. And that means that they're often supplying food, for example, to slave masters who may or may not share it with the people that the UN workers simply think happen to be workers in the field, not, in fact, enslaved people. So it's about raising the awareness within it, but also making it more of a priority within the United Nations.
Well, it sounds not acting like not acting as silos, you know, where, well, where we're here to address this, and then there's another component to address this, because as you're saying, it's all connected.
It's absolutely connected. And, you know, here's a classic one. In fact, a very simple thing. We can all remember back before the last Gulf War, when the United Nations had weapons inspectors going into Iraq and to other places, looking to see if there were weapons of mass destruction. Now, that was based on United Nations resolutions and conventions. But guess what? We've got the same types of resolutions, United Nations resolutions and conventions, to do with slavery. But there's no such thing as a United Nations slavery inspector. Well, why not? And why, you know, and if there were, I can point them in a number of places they might want to start.
You'd be their go-to guy for where to start that program. And just very quickly, what about the European Union? What is Western Europe doing about this?
Well, I have to say the individual states of the European Union. But now remember, of course, the European Union has now expanded to the point that it includes almost all of Eastern Europe as well as Western Europe. It's and down all the way, you know, toward Turkey and so forth. But the European Union has very clear general policies as well as its own human rights regulations and authorities. But the individual countries, you can really just point to a kind of levels of differences there in that, you know, you take a Sweden or Norway, Great Britain, pretty good policies going on there. Italy is in a bit of a muddle, Greece more so, and they need to also put more focus and more attention and some more resources into it, because now there's actually a fair bit of trafficking going on within Europe itself, since the flow of people in trafficking tends to go from poorer countries to richer countries. That means the poorer countries of Eastern Europe are still feeding trafficking victims into the richer countries of Western Europe.
Kevin, we have only about a minute or so left, and the third prong, of course, is our individuals. And you said earlier, you know, you're not suggesting that we all stop or start boycotting all coffee, all chocolate, all cell phones, but what can the individual person do to help?
I think the most important thing is to first learn a bit more so that they understand what the problem's about, because you can't fix a problem you can't understand. But the other second thing is, until we get sufficient resources from governments to get this job done, we really, sadly, have to ask for the average citizen to help support the work of liberation and rehabilitation around the world. The good news is that the cost of getting people out of slavery is actually pretty darn low. The average around the world is about $400 to get people out of slavery and then help them to completely rebuild their lives. And if you multiply that up by the 27 million people on the earth in slavery, it's only about $11 billion, which is nothing compared to, say, one of the recent bank bailouts. And, you know, that's something we could all, if only Americans, I think if every American put in 58 cents, would be there.
Very thought-provoking hour. Thanks to our callers for joining in, and certainly to our guest. Thank you, Dr. Kevin Bales. It's been a pleasure to have you with us today.
Julie, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Dr. Bales is founder and president of Free the Slaves, a Washington, D.C.-based human rights organization. He is also the recipient of the 2011 University of Louisville Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. He earned it for his book, Ending Slavery, How We Free Today's Slaves. For more information about that topic or about our program, you can go to WFPL.org, click on State of Affairs. Email us from there, follow us on Twitter at SOA Talk or on Facebook, or call us 502-814-6500. State of Affairs is produced by Louisville Public Media with support from the University of Louisville. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Our assistant is Carol Spangler. From the WFPL studios in Louisville, I'm Julie Credens. Thanks for listening.
The views presented on State of Affairs do not necessarily reflect those of the University of Louisville, Louisville Public Media, or its underwriters.